The American experiment is under review, and the only way forward is for us to figure out what we have to undo.
That is Tamara Towles O'Loughlin of 350.org talking about connections between Black Lives Matter, the coronavirus pandemic, and climate change. We'll hear from her on this podcast and from Tanya Shaires, an undocumented dreamer brought to the U.S. at the age of 5.
Every single week, I have a tendency to wake up and just immediately Google, like, Supreme Court DACA decision. Did it happen today? Did it not happen? And that's my ritual every week.
Will Tanya be deported to Mexico? We'll talk with her and another dreamer, her fiancé, who might be deported to Chile. But first, it's systemic racism and the presidential campaign. The words Black Lives Matter are now painted in massive letters on 16th Street, not far from the White House, a challenge to President Trump from the mayor of Washington, D.C. But somebody else painted the phrase defund the police on the same street nearby. Now, here's the lead in a story from the Washington Examiner. Quote, President Trump's re-election campaign sees the defund the police proposals catching on in left-wing circles as an albatross to hang around Joe Biden's neck. The byline is W. James Antle III, and he joins us now. Jim Antle, welcome.
Good to be here, Warren.
Just to prove your point, here's what President Trump had to say on Monday.
There won't be defunding. There won't be dismantling of our police. Sometimes you'll see some horrible things like we witnessed recently, but 99.9, but let's go with 99% of them are great, great people.
So, Jim Antle, tell us how the Trump campaign plans to hang this on Joe Biden.
Well, I think it's part of a larger general strategy of trying to put Biden in a position where he either has to take progressive positions that they feel will alienate swing voters, especially in those key battleground states in the Rust Belt, or that he has to so forcefully disavow those positions that it runs the risk of demoralizing some of his more progressive supporters, maybe discouraging some of them from turning out. So when they began the whole pitch on defund the police, the Biden campaign hadn't really taken a firm position on it. They basically had not commented on news stories about it, and it had seemed a bit equivocal. But after they spent a morning, the Trump campaign, that is, spent a morning with surrogates and with the president himself trying to draw Biden out on this issue, the campaign did release a statement that fairly flatly said that while the vice president wants to see certain reforms of law enforcement, is concerned about the issue, he doesn't actually support defund the police, which then reverted to the Trump campaign trying to pressure Biden himself to say this in his own words, perhaps more emphatically. So, you know, on the one hand, it's going to be a little bit difficult to pin this on Biden since he has disavowed the defund movement. On the other hand, the strategy is to either force him to take the position they think is unpopular or force him to demoralize the left flank of his own base.
Well, now, since the statement that was released by the Biden campaign, Biden himself has, in fact, had something to say about it, and here it is.
No, I don't support defunding the police. I support conditioning federal aid to police based on whether or not they meet certain basic standards of decency and honorableness, and in fact are able to demonstrate they can protect the community and everybody in the community.
So, Jim Antle, back to you. It would appear that Joe Biden recognizes a dangerous political slogan when he sees it.
That's right. And there is a lot of debate among supporters of defund the police over what exactly that phrase means. You know, and there have been various conservative campaigns to defund things, whether it's defund Obamacare, defund Planned Parenthood, even defund NPR. It's pretty straightforward that they're talking about withdrawing taxpayer funding from the institution that is, or entity that is the object of defund. Here, a lot of people who say they support defunding the police argue that they're really talking about redirecting some funds that are currently allocated to law enforcement towards social services and other budget priorities. And there are other activists, however, who are a bit more serious about the idea of disbanding police forces. And so I think certain Democrats don't want to be tied to that slogan because they don't like the more extreme version of what it might mean. And it's very difficult to explain why defund the police may not mean defund the police. So that's, for that reason, Trump and the Republicans sense an opportunity here to at the very least divide the Democratic voting blocks against themselves.
Is this an effort, do you think, to divert attention away from the claim and the concern, which seems to be expressed by so many people taking to the streets all over the country for the last couple of weeks, about what is referred to as systemic racism? Does the president simply not want to talk about that?
Well, I think they've taken a pretty straightforward position that they are arguing that the problems in law enforcement are isolated bad apples. And while they're open to supporting potentially some reforms, and Republicans have tasked Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina with coming up with a GOP response to some of the police reforms that the congressional Democrats are unveiling, that they want to say that most of these issues stem from isolated bad apples within police departments rather than systemic racism, whereas Joe Biden is willing to say that it is a product of systemic racism. The Trump campaign doesn't want to take the position of calling police officers, of calling cops on the beat racist, unless there's very specific and clear-cut examples of an injustice like we saw in the George Floyd video.
President Trump's been accused of racism since he first announced for the presidency. He made that attack on Mexicans. He's told congresswomen of color to go back where you came from. He saw good people on both sides of the Ku Klux Klan rally in Charlottesville and so on. Does it appear that the campaign for law and order, which he has put it that way himself, is risky for him at this point, given the national outcry about what happened in Minneapolis?
You know, Trump has tried to be pretty careful, I think, to put himself on the side of criticizing and being against what happened to George Floyd, and not really even being quite as straightforward in his support of law enforcement as one might have expected. But, you know, Trump doesn't get a lot of benefit of the doubt on these questions, and many would argue that he hasn't earned the benefit of the doubt on racial issues. So therefore, you know, there is a risk for him, and it is difficult for him to talk about these issues while seeming to be seriously aligned with calls for racial justice, without at the same time abandoning his base, which, you know, didn't like the scenes that they saw in the cities of the more violent forms of the protests, and would like to see the phrase law and order, which, you know, has always been a controversial phrase when used dating back to the 1960s.
Well, that's right. It was used, of course, by George Wallace, and Richard Nixon picked it up, and it certainly worked for him. The question is, does it still apply today? And if it doesn't, is Trump liable to lay himself open to charges that he is, in fact, appealing to racism on the part of voters?
That's a criticism that Democrats are certainly going to make. I think that Joe Biden's already said in his own remarks that he vows not to fan the flames of hatred, which imply that the president has done that. I think a larger difficulty as well is that it's easier to run as somebody who's going to restore law and order if you are the challenger. It is harder, which Richard Nixon effectively was in 1968 against Hubert Humphrey. It's a little bit harder to run that way when whatever disorder is happening while you're the incumbent. So, you know, Trump is under pressure simultaneously to appear to want to do something about the problems in law enforcement that we keep hearing and seeing, and that George Floyd is only the latest example of, while at the same time, a lot of his own constituency, a lot of his own base wants to not see any looting and wants to not see any more violent protests in the streets of the major cities. So Trump really has to walk a difficult line here, and he's not necessarily well known for his message discipline. So this is a tough challenge for for him.
not well known for message discipline. In fact, he's gotten himself in a lot of trouble recently because of the way he described the situation in Buffalo, where the white elderly man with white hair was pushed down by the policeman, and the president picked up a conspiracy theory about that that he found on a rather obscure television network that he seems now to be watching. Does it appear that he just simply watched that broadcast and then repeated what he had seen without really thinking about it?
That does actually seem to be the most plausible explanation. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of what George W. Bush might call strategery involved in this. I mean, I do think that the president does sometimes like to make the press go look at the shiny object, but I'm not necessarily sure that that's what happened here. I think it is simply he saw a broadcast, said, gee, is this really happening? Is this thing I saw on TV true? The funny thing is, a lot of his supporters are very much like that themselves, and that's one of the reasons that he has bonded with them so successfully. Is, you know, they're watching a lot of cable news and getting outraged by what they see on it, and the president does this mostly through Twitter. He doesn't tend to talk about these things as much in live, although the rally speeches, I guess, are the big exception to that. But Twitter really is a thing that he does while he's sitting around watching television, and these things then tend to come out.
In addition to Twitter, of course, there's not just Fox News, but also what is referred to as the disinformation ecology, and the way that it works in the social media. Is the campaign as invested in that as we have been told in The Atlantic and other such places?
Well, I think certainly the Trump campaign wants to change conversations in a way that is more favorable to them, and that they are not as punctilious necessarily about how that is done as many more conventional political figures would be. And so whether that is an elaborate disinformation campaign or whether it's simply being very plugged in to a Twitter ecosystem and a social media ecosystem in which there are no gatekeepers and some problems with factual accuracy is hard to say. But definitely the Trump campaign is very plugged into what people are talking about on Twitter and what types of things are upsetting or animating the base to try to motivate them to maintain their support of the president.
It appears that the Biden campaign is not as well equipped to deal in that area as was the Obama campaign. There have been some concerns expressed about that by the Democrats. So I wonder if this will be, in that sense, a different kind of balance.
It's the Biden campaign is not the most tech savvy campaign, which is interesting given that he served as vice president under Barack Obama. The Obama campaigns were famous for being on the cutting edge in the digital area and in these areas. It is a disadvantage. You know, if Biden can maintain his current polling lead, it's not going to matter very much. If the race tightens, it could matter a great deal. So it's something that bears watching.
Okay, it does indeed. And as is always said, and it's said even a week before the campaign, before the election itself, there's a long time to go. And a lot of changes no doubt will occur in the meantime. James W. Antle III with the Washington Examiner. It's great to have you with us. Thanks a lot.
Good to be here, Warren. Thank you.
So the killing of George Floyd is already part of the presidential campaign, while Black Lives Matter is the subject of protests all over the world, with protesters chanting Floyd's last words, "I can't breathe." That turns out to be a very powerful phrase. "I can't breathe" is the consequence of police racism on the streets of America. It's also an agonizing symptom of COVID-19, and it's another consequence of the greenhouse emissions that are accelerating climate change. That's the focus of 350.org, where Tamara Tolles O'Loughlin is North American director. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me. So glad to be here.
What do you mean? There's a deafening amount of silence.
I think for organizations that have been around over 100 years in some cases, I can say this because 350 is turning 11. So all, for all intents and purposes, we're fairly middle age as far as environmental organizations go, either just started or they're over 100 years old. And given that race has been an issue since America invented it, it's pretty tough to feel like if one of the first things we've moved to as a progressive left culture over 100 years is conservation, protection of resources, and not had any practice whatsoever for how to deal with the people, that's a design flaw. And so it feels a lot like if those organizations still exist and have yet to come up with a practice for how to deal with people, that's a choice. And so the, what's not being said is saying a lot.
What's the choice? What have they chosen then, are you saying?
It feels a lot like it's easier to talk about a river or a stream or fishing as though human beings don't make impacts and are not a part of an ecosystem that includes them. When I talk about the development of policy, I often make an analogy that the way that we have designed environmental work, environmental law, environmental practice is like going to a party. I'm going to date myself. And when you come back from the party, you have tons of Polaroids, you've shaken them all, and you're not in a single photo because you were too busy taking photos of the good time to have one yourself. And so it feels a lot like the policies that are in place, the practices that we use, the structures we have built to protect the planet do not have a practice that includes how people show up, what their lives are like, or the decisions we've made about who has resources and what that means for relationship to the environment.
There's a great quote from Matthias Lehmann, who's digital director for the Sunrise Movement. And he got his start in the Black Lives Movement. But he says, the perception I always had as a person of color growing up in this country is environmentalism was a separate thing. It was something for white people who liked big animals.
Charismatic megafauna. I always joke that my favorite of them are human beings. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because if you look at the work of environmental protection, of resource protection, of protection of public and private lands, it often looks like a lone white man standing in the forest trying to determine what the world will look like. And that is not what any of environmental work should be striving for. It's not what the imagery should hold. It makes no room for what we've built since then, wrongly or rightly, and creates a lot of silos that drop a lot of the population through what enjoyment would look like or what services would do to bring in the largest number of people. Given that we have lots of folks moving into cities, even in this moment, people choose to live their lives in closest proximity to one another and to resources and for purposes of smart growth as opposed to sprawl, and us not having a practice as environmental knowledge workers that includes what people's lives are like when they live in a rural space, what includes what their lives are like when they choose to live in urban space, and every other version of that. If we don't have environmental work that speaks to people where they are, water, air, and access to health become really distant concepts. And it feels like a luxury item when it shouldn't.
When I was in television in the 1960s in Washington, D.C., we were finally having African-American people come and be part of the news organizations. It was new in those days. And I remember talking to a new reporter who had come in and asking him about the environmental movement and about whether he thought it was important or not. This was in the 1960s again. But he had no idea what the Sierra Club was. I, having had a connection to it myself, was very surprised by that. But what you're suggesting is I shouldn't have been surprised by it at all, because we've been ignoring African-American people for a long time.
We have. And the original roots of environmental work that involved people has been turned into a singular concept of environmental justice, which overlaps lots of different experiences. Communities living next to bus depots, farm workers being sprayed with pesticides, and every kind of human experience in between. If it comes into contact with pollution, pipelines, compressor stations, factories, or anything that poisons the water and air, has been slotted into a justice work as though that's some separate silo of how we appreciate or live in the world. And I think it's been interesting in having the public dialogue around this become a function of COVID, climate, and the uprising that's happening. We're in a moment where failing to address the climate crisis hits right smack dab in the middle of a few other systems crashing at the same time. And there are a lot of really great efforts coming together to point us in a direction of surviving what Bill McKibben calls the time test of the climate decade. But there's nothing about that that happens if we don't develop a practice for how we address poverty, how we address race, how we address the fact that Black people in America have been being poisoned regardless of their income. So you could be wealthy and be sited near the worst of air quality zoning permits that place you in the backdrop and context of polluting facilities, and then compound those with not just one, not just two. I'm here today from Baltimore, and there are communities within a stone's throw of me that sit in the middle of six different polluting factories and outfits that provide import-export facilities, energy generation and transmission. None of that is by accident, it's by design. And as environmentalists, we should care as much about that as we do about charismatic megafauna.
I just have to say that you're kind of an embodiment of what it is you're advocating, because you're a person of color now involved with a major environmental organization. How did that happen?
Let's see. It's been about 20 years of of working on, I started the Department of Environmental Protection in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I put myself through college. And every three years subsequent to that period, I tried on different jobs inside of the environment and started to come away with the idea that it wasn't about how many skills I could gather, how much information I could have. There was no right fit for an environmental line of business that does not imagine that African Americans can have strategic capacity, intellectual power, or the right to make decisions about how they're addressed in this space. So over the course of that 20-year window, I spent a lot of time learning about the problems, thinking about environmental organizations, partnering with other folks in the work to figure out how can we do something we believe in if it doesn't believe in us. And some of that's taken the form of relationships like the Green Leadership Trust, which is a board organization that puts together Black, Indigenous, and people of color across green groups, including everyone you could think of, and some that have been around forever, from Population Connection to American Rivers to Sierra Club to your local environmental community board. We have Black, Indigenous, and people of color who get together and think about their work as board members who are fiduciaries for the long-term health of an organization. And one of the things we realized was missing was a racial practice, no analysis. How could we possibly serve an America that will look browner, that will look blacker, that will look more like the diversity that would have existed without so much violence and suppression in the future, if there are no programs to access those communities, to be in relationship with them, or, for example, to make sure that park space is enjoyed equally by people regardless of their financial status or other relationships. So for me, it's been a lot of trial and error, and then a lot of getting into relationship with other folks to ask good questions. I've been fortunate enough to have a formal education in some of these things, but it all for me started growing up near Prospect Park in Brooklyn, New York, and starting with the premise that as a city-dwelling human being, I had every right to run through the park and experience the lake and run for as long as I could until I, you know, got in trouble for being out too late as a kid, and to enjoy the green space that had been built by folks who recognized that without a common green space, city life is pretty difficult. So growing up with access to really impressive green space in Brooklyn, designed by Green Streets programming and lots of resources, I have had the opportunity to move in and out of those experiences and know that that's not true by design in a lot of other places. So I think looking at my own experience, comparing it to other folks, doing a lot of sense making, trying to relate to what is and isn't happening, and then looking with others to determine what kinds of things can we build to solve this problem. Among other groups that I participate in, I am a part of, I'm on the advisory board of Climate Power 2020, which is a group of folks who really have gotten together to make sure we're clear that as we move into this general election period, we are not forgetting that ignoring experts, not believing science, and pretending that we're just going to solve problems if we skirt around the margins of them, we'll get anything done. So I would say that I'm a someone who is not afraid to make experiments, to ask questions, and to get together with other folks to figure it out. And I'm a part of trying to make it so that it's less of a that folks have more of a streamlined process of being in relationship with work they want to do, because there's nothing about environmental work that should be a luxury experience.
Let's get back to New York City, where you said you grew up and you were running as long as you could in Prospect Park. What about the planning process that is described by Robert Caro when he talks about Robert Moses and the way that that city was put together, not just without concern, but with an eye to segregation, to separating the races and keeping African Americans very particularly on the other side of the freeway?
Yeah, so when I talk about Prospect Park, it reminds me of a park in Kentucky that Frederick Law Olmsted designed, and Central Park, which is the one everyone knows. And I used to think that Prospect Park was like a secret until the late 80s. People rediscovered it. And I said, I don't have to go all the way to Manhattan to enjoy this beautiful green space. The same guy built this one and it's just as cool, but nobody knows about it. And so I think recognizing that you can compare two folks who conceivably, based on the time they were in, were probably a racist at the level of a man who lives in that time, when the prevailing winds say that you deserve privilege, that whiteness is harmless, and that you can appreciate it without hurting anyone else. So if you have Frederick Law Olmsted and you have Robert Moses, and you look at what they did with their power to carve out from the earth spaces where people will spend time together, build their lives, live and die. All that stuff happens because we have built it to happen. Frederick Law Olmsted made some choices about communal space and giving people access. Robert Moses ripped up the shorelines, moved highways and made bridges too low for people to be able to pass, moved channels and redesigned cities to separate communities, created the concept of suburbia, and as a master builder, created and deepened the lack of transportation that would keep equity from moving with people as they gained access to resources. So there was a really malevolent design to keep people separate, to design their lives out of access to a healthy environment or green space. And when you think about those things as elements of city planning and you start to zone out from it, it isn't just my hometown where that's true. Folks in Minneapolis will say the same. And it isn't a surprise that so many of the issues that plague African-American communities, Black, Indigenous people of color across the board have aspects to them that are not just about how they experience their everyday lives, but how they were designed into them by zoning, by permitting, by malevolent and exclusive design. Vernice Miller Travis calls it exclusive design. She's an actual city planner. I dabble. And so it's been really, really incredible to find that in moments like this, where the country is in unrest over the murder of George Floyd, we are finding out a number of things, not just about the incident that led to his death, but the way that his community was designed. The fact that because of all of these things, our addiction to fossil fuels and a poor design that segregates people and subjects them to poor health because they're exposed to transportation related pollution, they then have air quality issues that weaken their organs and make them more likely to be successful to COVID. So there's nothing about this moment that we're in that isn't about design, that isn't about harm, and isn't about exclusivity blowing up in America's face.
Yeah, you talked about New York City, you talked about Minneapolis and other cities as well, and certainly here in Los Angeles, the same thing is true. Over the years, it has been constructed in such a way as to separate people, the most recent example being the 105 freeway, which simply divided a whole neighborhood and made it difficult for people to get back and forth from one place to another and have relationships with one another that they had counted on for years. So is this a moment when these things, do you think, can come together and have an opportunity to come together as we see all of these people marching in the streets all over the country?
I think it's a time for us to start undoing some things. It is strange moment, not because we're in the middle of an uprising because people have had enough, but because we have such an opportunity to look in the face of the system that has felt unshakable, unmoving, and like it was capable of delivering just enough services to people that the largest group of folks would feel satisfied or at least condemned to live with it. We're in a moment where the threads of the democracy are bare, where people's ability to count on basic services from a government they have subscribed to in a social contract that they were born into is not serving them. So it feels a lot like it's also a good moment to recognize who is making the most of multiple tragedies. As oil, coal, and gas companies get $50 million in taxpayer money during the pandemic, there are communities full of people by waiting with bated breath to find out, will they get a $1,200 check to make them really unlikely to meet any of their needs, but would be better than nothing given that the close of the economy to protect people's health has foreclosed the social safety net. It really raises questions of why do we live in a country where you have to have a job in order to have health care, which means you can't be sick unless you're healthy enough to work, or you're subject to really awful scrutiny under a bureaucracy that doesn't see your humanity. That's not a driver of this moment. It is a thing that is also happening. It is also happening that when you pay money for your taxes and that is spent divided up and spent at the state level and federal level and across services that are supposed to be for your community and ends up being the very resources that are used against you when politicians don't take your calls about concerns you have, where they stand behind police unions and police forces and first responders who are being told to ignore your humanity and to treat you like you should be regulated to death, even if that means harming you as you exercise your First Amendment rights. So I think the American experiment is under review, and the only way forward is for us to figure out what we have to undo. I think ripping up some highways, giving people access to good jobs, infrastructure that actually serves our chosen purpose at this moment, and human health is a good way to go. So as we are in this moment, I'm looking at my undo list.
You really mean rip up the highways?
Yeah, I mean, I think if what they've done is condemn people in suburbia and in cities to separation, to poor health, expose them to a fossil fuel economy that they can't get off of because they can't see their everyday lives without it, it would be easier to do that than to allow this unraveling to continue.
So on the other hand, if you just tear things up, that's not going to solve the problem, is it? Don't you have to be systematic about it and replace the freeway, if that's what you want to tear up, with some other way of getting from one place to another?
Yes, but I think there are some things that we could do for the planet that would make that fairly easy. We have recognized that the current design of the Eisenhower highway system, for all intents and purposes, was built to move people at a different time under different circumstances. In the last few years of the climate decade, we will not have the ability to reverse our course on fossil fuels. So recognizing that we could solve two problems at once by dealing with poor design that is malevolent and separates communities and putting in things like fast rail and electrified transportation that is more focused on communal transportation and what new uses people need, we can prioritize those things and respond to a couple of problems at once. So, the undo list is long, but it also presents a real opportunity for us to make some corrections. And people are out in the street demanding corrections.
If you watch the news these days, you see a lot of advertising for insurance companies. You wrote a piece, or co-wrote a piece, in Rolling Stone magazine, really scathing about the insurance companies. Tell us why you think they are such villains in this piece.
Largely because they're unseen. I'll talk about McGruff the crime dog and date myself further and say that when I was a kid, they would show McGruff the crime dog finding out whether something bad was happening. And the question was, is the villain the person that you think you're looking at? In the case of big oil, big insurance, and ignoring what people need, they're all fairly guilty. But big oil, coal, and gas are the easier targets to see because what comes out of their smokestacks and all of the byproducts of their business are expensive and deadly. But what underwrites all of that happening is what we wrote about in Rolling Stone, which, given the state of the market, it seems like a set of poor investments that we've all bought into. But at the end of the day, what we're talking about is, what does it mean to be someone who lives in fire and lives through fire and flood season and may have to replace your home? If you live on any of the island nations or territories connected to the United States, or even on the Florida panhandle, you know what it means to try to find hurricane insurance or flood insurance for what happens to you every day. In Maryland, here in Talbot County, folks are watching their baseball diamond fill up every evening in the summer with water when that never happened, as the seashore erodes away in the Chesapeake Bay. So when you are a homeowner, someone who has bought into the system, someone who spends a lot of time just trying to get from point A to point B and enjoy your life, and you have paid into the system to get insurance, you expect that money to come in. But companies like Liberty Mutual are pulling out of that business. They don't want to support flood and fire insurance because climate change makes it more likely. But those same companies are the only people who can help a document move through a process of permitting for a pipeline, compressor station, well pad. They all must be insured against liability. And those same companies operate in that space, causing and accelerating climate change, and then leave you holding the bag when it literally comes to your doorstep. So it felt like, I'm not someone who generally swears in a public writing, but we had to call BS on it, because at that moment, it felt like, how can you take our money, put it into the common wheel, and then refuse to pay out the people who are hurt by the first investment you make? You could make investments in community that look a lot like the ones we described.
We also talk about stranded assets and how the kind of things that they're protecting might very soon not be all that productive of the kind of wealth the insurance companies and the investors are hoping for.
Yes, I think. The idea that a stranded asset for a business that started hundreds of years ago has paid absolutely no dues to community and continued to operate in a monopoly. It's an interesting time to talk about stranded assets and investments, when many of the current investments that are being made now, usually through the auspices of governors, are about what the future looks like. And we already had the information. Bill McKibben, amongst so many other voices, have been talking about what it would mean to pivot the economy from a fossil fuel addicted one to a green, generative, and renewable economy. So we had about 30 years to start making investments. And so the time to talk about stranded assets and the debt that we will have to absorb is looking at the exact wrong party and not thinking about what our shared costs will be if we continue to hurl towards a climate crisis.
You mentioned Bill McKibben. Of course, he's the leader of 350.org. That's the organization you work for. But let's turn for a moment to politics. Joe Biden has Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez now enlisted to sort of bring the left part of the party into his moderate wing. Are you part of that? Do you think environmental organizations ought to get on board?
So 350 Action, which is the political C4 arm of 350.org, has really been thinking a lot about what does it take to move a climate president, regardless of who's in that chair. These issues and the time test of climate are not political. They're not partisan. But the way that we deal with people and resources is. So getting into that space, being involved in that conversation, means recognizing that we have to put up works every day to defend against it, ignoring of experts, refusing to believe in science, and surrendering our government to coal, oil, and gas under the current administration. And so a part of that work is happening in 350. A part of it is happening in Climate Power 2020, which is the organization I referred to, of just a bunch of nerds like myself who really want to make sure that we don't fail to recognize that we're in a moment where all of these things are going to have to be decided by who ends up in the public space. At this very moment, as we talk, 76% of swing voters are uncomfortable with the fact that the person who sits in the White House, Donald Trump, ignores the advice of folks we trust, scientists, doctors, military leaders, public health experts, all of whom would have prevented us from going as deeply into the multiple crises, compound crises that we're facing. We recognize that at this very moment, 98% 98 specific and different environmental public health protections have been rolled back. That's going to have multi-generational impacts. And at 350.org and at 350 Action, that's what we care about, is what's happening in this generation that will affect the next one. Are we recognizing that giving out huge sums of money to keep the old work going has impacts on the next generation right now, is divesting us from being able to make plans in the future? Yeah, heck yeah. We're super excited about what an election that is focused on these issues could do to raise the climate ambition of the big C community, what investments that move money away from old dead dinosaur oil and into the future, what that would look like. How do we solve and deal straight ahead with the racial issues that we've been facing if we take on an environmental justice lens, and recognize that environmental justice isn't just some amorphous frame, but that it happens in the context of workers and communities, people who have been given jobs in unsustainable work, people who do not have jobs as those forms of work has died away, and the fact that they live in communities without a social safety net. And so part of our reason for getting into this conversation is that somebody has to pay to fix it. The undo list is as expensive as what has to be done after it. And there are folks who've made money hand over a fist, ignoring us about the oncoming peril.
Is this a way, do you think, of appealing to the young people who at the moment don't seem to be very certain about how they ought to vote or even whether they ought to vote?
I think initiatives like this, young people pushing themselves into the civil society, really pushing for movement from the streets into the narrow halls where decisions are made, that is about self-preservation. The system that we currently have, which we've talked a little bit about in this conversation, is one where there are no investments for young people. If you don't have a pension, if all you have is debt, if you work in a gig economy, you do not have the promise of a job now or in the future, there is absolutely zero incentive to get involved in systemic change. But recognizing that a general election has real consequences, that you live under an administration that decides whether or not you have access to any of those things, that the folks in the down ballot races in every state, from Kentucky to New Mexico to Arizona to Maryland, these are all the kinds of decisions that get made in this moment. So I think any and everybody who's out in the street has a real reason to get into the voting booth, because the context under which all of these things are decided happen during an election year. And so if we have any chance at taking back the White House because we want to live, like to make the basic case that human life is worth preserving at every level, recognizing that just ignoring extreme weather and the fact that it's taken lives, making sure that workers are supported and that it isn't just loans to CEOs to pay themselves for losses for having a failing business, that we are making sure that the people who put their nose to the grindstone every day to bring home money are not left hanging as a result of it. Recognizing general corruption when it's happening, and that science already gave us the blueprint on what's happening. I think it's really important to recognize that the folks in the street are really smart, and they're aware that this is only one way to make things happen. And and many of them have already spoken out that if this does not translate into changes in the way that the system is run, there will be no reason to continue to presume that there's anything in it for them. So this election is huge for young people. At 350, we like to call it multi-generational, multi-racial. That's the mix we're going for in our work, in our campaigns, and in our programs. And recognizing that if we don't get everyone to care about this, we'll be here again for another 4 years and smack dab in the middle of the climate decade.
Well, is there a risk of going too far? When you talk about tearing up the freeways and disrupting the cities, are you liable to scare people away? You know, at least some people, particularly older people, who are, of course, the ones who vote the most often.
Not in my experience. In the position I'm in at 350, where I spent a lot of time with our executive director, May Bouvy, and our amazing organizers across the world, let me tell you, older people, I like to call them seasoned activists, are the first ones who want to run into the street. They are throwing up a cape and running out there. They like, I've had a lot of years of health. It's time to make sure that what's left of the world is a good place to be in, or at least represents what they have had access to. So the old folks I know aren't buying it. Like they are not worried about preserving the status quo. They do not feel that the murder of George Floyd in the context of a pandemic and the continued erasure of vulnerable people is an acceptable status quo. So much of our base is full of folks who are experienced, who have had a lifelong commitment to this work, and they are donating money to bail funds. In the space of 2 days, our base has donated over $100,000 directly to help people get out of jail. And these are climate folks, like dyed in the wool, as long as it's organic, sustainable, and non-toxic. You know, these are the folks who we're talking about. And they could care less about holding the status quo or making it work for everyone, because they are really clear that we're only in this moment because it isn't working for everyone. So I think that deciding that some mystical opposition might be unhappy, look outside your window. There are millions of people. Every single state is full of people who are tired of pretending that the way things are going is a way that they can see themselves having a happy, sustainable life on a planet that will actually be here for us.
How do you feel about Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson, who wrote extensively in the Washington Post? She's a marine biologist and also a native of Brooklyn. Who said that she is exhausted at having to deal with these problems and find them so frustrating and so difficult, particularly because of the racial aspects of things. When she says, if you want to successfully address climate change, you really need people of color.
So Ayanna is a colleague of mine and a friend and a fellow Brooklynite. I'm from Flatbush. She's from Fort Greene. So
I thought there sounded like some similarities between the two of you.
So I would say the good cheesecake is on her side of town. If you move across the road to Red Hook and you meet Elizabeth Jean-Pierre at Uprose, then we have a battle about whose pizza's better. So I think the only things that we would disagree on are perhaps cheesecake and pizza. There's nothing in the writing that she wrote that isn't true. I mean, she works primarily on oceans because they are just this massive sink of every good and bad thing we ever do. And so as someone who's focused on a lot of the other space in the conversation, there's nothing I can disagree with in her sentiment. The idea that we have to focus on race is a leftover from times when we could have done this. There was a time when racially restrictive covenants kept people in communities, which were about more than race, but also ethnicity. There are folks who just couldn't live in community with anyone they wanted because we designed it so that wasn't true. Given that that eventually stopped being true in most cases, at least on the face of the law, we have had other moments where we could have made these decisions. And because we didn't, the problems have festered and they're here and we have to deal with them now. So I think Ayanna is tired. Elizabeth is tired. I am tired. Jackie Patterson is tired. Bernice Miller-Traver is tired. Heck, there isn't anybody working in any environmental organization or outside of one who will tell you that the state of environmental work is serving our needs, that the government is responding to our basic human desires to be safe, have our garbage taken out on time, and not catch a disease that'll kill you because we didn't know it was coming. So I think that what she expressed in the Post article was just a sliver of what we've been saying for a long time. And for the record, she's also a member of the Green Leadership Trust. So she's a frustrated board member of color who's also tired of watching the structures we've built to help us defend against environmental degradation fail to show up in that space. So she's also a part of that change work.
Well, it's fascinating to talk with you. You're a real education, and I'm just delighted that we've been able to spend this time with Tamara Tolles O'Loughlin of 350.org. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a strange set of days, so it was nice to take a pause.
In a moment, as promised, to DACA recipients who want to get married but might be deported to different countries. Back in a moment with To The Point. Alejandro Fuentes Mena and Tanya Shaides have a house in Denver, Colorado, and they want to get married. He's a math teacher, and she's a Wharton Business School graduate who started a nonprofit. But they've held off on the wedding bells because they might end up moving to different countries, even though they don't want to do that. Their future is in the hands of the U.S. Supreme Court because they are dreamers. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
I have to tell our listeners, we heard about you from a podcast project called Shoebox Stories, where celebrities read your words to see how it feels to be in your position and stand in your shoes. And we want to know about that, too. And Tanya, let me start with you. Remind our listeners how you got to be dreamers. What does that mean?
So it means we are in this country undocumented, but we came when we were children. I actually came to the United States when I was 5, and Alejandro came when he was 4. So we've been here for literally the majority of our lives at this point. And so very much intertwined in the very fabric of the United States.
And you came from Mexico.
I did, yeah. I was born in Chihuahua, Mexico, and I was raised in Phoenix, Arizona. So I only got to Colorado a bit more recently. I left Arizona after the very anti-immigrant SB 1070 came into effect. And so you could sort of call it fleeing Arizona and coming to sanctuary in Colorado.
And Denver's a sanctuary city.
It's very different than Arizona. I'm really thankful to be here, though the trauma of everything that I lived through still follows me today, for sure.
Alejandro, you were brought here from Chile, and you were 4 years old. How would you feel if you had to be deported back to Chile?
I guess the short answer is not that great. The long answer is, even though Chile is a beautiful place, it is not what I call home. Because I was raised in San Diego, California, up until from 4 to 18, then went to school in Washington and then landed here in Denver, Colorado about 7 years ago. I consider these areas my homes. This is where I had most of my formative thoughts, where I became the individual that I am today, the educator that I am today. That all happened within this country, and being forced to go back to Chile, as beautiful as it might be, because I know Valparaíso is very picturesque, it would not be something that I could call home. In fact, sometimes I get down on myself because people will be like, oh, you're Chilean. What's some of the like most modern Chilean music, or what is it that you enjoy eating that's of Chilean culture? And I don't have an answer. And it's because I haven't embedded myself in that culture, which is due to me having to assimilate myself to American values and culture in order to somewhat be accepted in this country.
Starting out when you were 4 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
So Tanya, let's just more to remind our listeners than anything else. The idea of dreamers comes from the DREAM Act. That was a bipartisan bill designed to protect people like yourselves from deportation, give them work permits. It never passed. So Barack Obama signed DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And what would that do, or how does that protect you?
Sure. So DACA, as you said, Deferred Action, is a 2-year work permit. We get to renew it every 2 years. And it's sort of been stuck for the past few years since this new administration tried to sort of terminate the program. And as it battles itself out in court, there are no new renewals. And so people who would qualify for deferred action can't apply. But those of us who already have it can continue to renew. And so every 2 years, we pay $500. And for Alejandro and I, since we're in one household, it's $1,000 to get 2 more years of safety, which is really crazy because it sort of means that we have this like little expiration date on everything we do. And that expiration date is very clear right now as the Supreme Court is listening to comments on whether or not to terminate the program and listen to this administration or to do something else and return the program to its full glory, I guess. And I mean, it really what it does is allow us to work, right? It gives us a social security number. It allows us to have safety from deportation. It ensures that I can continue to work on this podcast that you mentioned earlier, the Modus Theater Shoebox Stories podcast, and uplift the stories of other immigrant communities. And it allows me to work in education and engage with communities. And I, as the Supreme Court decision looms closer, it makes me feel really anxious, you know, for lack of better words.
Anxious, I suspect, is a very good word to describe it. And Alejandro, let me go back to you. Were you anxious growing up as an undocumented person in the United States?
Absolutely. I think the way that it developed or the way that it showed itself was the way that I started treating myself after seeing how my parents were treated and taken advantage of growing up. In the monologue that Jose Andres reads in Shoebox Stories, I basically share this narrative where both my mom and dad would do all these crazy jobs and be paid less than what they were worth. And I saw that as a means of like, oh, if that's how they treat undocumented individuals, I am an undocumented individual. What is therefore the point of me trying in school? And so during middle school, I had a very rough patch, even though I was like a gifted and talented student, where I wasn't doing that well academically. And the reason why I wasn't doing well academically was because in my head, I had already formulated the idea of like, what is the point of me trying if at the end of the day, I'm probably going to end up working construction, just like my father, but not be paid what I'm worth. And so I ended up becoming an individual that wasn't necessarily academically focused, because I thought in my own head, like the anxiety displayed itself and it's reared its head as an individual who was just going to follow along with the statistics and not necessarily prove all that he was worth. And if it wasn't for one teacher and one mentor, backing me up in the way that she did. And if it wasn't for the support of my parents telling me that I needed to keep going, I don't know where I would necessarily be today, because it's very easy to fall under the constant hate and gaze of how American society ends up viewing you. And you, it's hard not to take it personally and then let that affect who you end up becoming.
Tanya, let me go back to you and tell us, if you will, how you feel now about what's going on in this country and the enormous support that there seems to be for Black people and people of color in general. Do you feel that that extends to you as well?
I think our narratives are so well intertwined. And I reference the quote often about how my liberation is tied to Black people's liberation. And so Alejandro and I have been out in the Black Lives Matter protests in support and in solidarity with our Black brothers and sisters. And I think, you know, it's important to note that immigration is also a Black issue. Oftentimes, the people who are sharing narratives are people who are Mexican or of Latino heritage. But there are many undocumented people who are also Black, and that intersectionality can't be forgotten.
Alejandro, what do you think are the most common misconceptions about people who are DACA recipients, such as yourselves?
We have proven over and over again, through the means of this quote-unquote experiment, that we have surpassed any expectations of what they expected of us as undocumented individuals. They've called us anything from lazy to taking advantage of the system. And what we are essentially trying to do is live our lives and show that we are excellent. We're excellent at what we do, and we have completely integrated and surpassed any expectations within this capitalistic society. And the reason why we have done that is because we realize that what we're fighting for and what we're working for is not only our own personal and individual selves, but also our community. We want to be able to show everybody that the sacrifice that our parents made once upon a time to get us to this country was well worth it.
Tanya, it's always important, it seems to me, when I hear these questions about or these issues were being raised about who's benefiting and who isn't, that whether you get salaries that are comparable to those of other people or not, even when you don't, you still have to pay taxes.
Absolutely. We pay a lot of money into the system of the United States. I mean, it's taxes, both state and federal. It's Social Security. It's all of the things that sometimes we don't get to see again. But I think you know, much broader than that, I also want to highlight that I'm not just an economic benefit to the country as an undocumented person. I think the U.S. benefits like so much off of my labor. And I think the best part about the Modus Theater Shoebox Stories podcast is that we get to highlight undocumented people as human beings, right? Not just capitalistic value that we bring. So it's both and that I think people should really pay attention to.
I love that point about being human beings. Can you elaborate a bit on that? Tell us more about the anxiety you described earlier and whether now you feel liberated because of your ability, you do have this opportunity to speak out first on the Shoebox Stories and now here.
Yeah. For the majority of my life, I have come and attested to this label that has been placed on me as undocumented. And the term undocumented is very limiting. It is a status that I was sort of brought into, that I was labeled because of the way that certain laws were worded. For a long time, I let it be the limiting factor in my life. And so I would say that once you overcome this label of being undocumented, it is just up to you in terms of whether or not and how much you're willing to fight for the injustices that you see in this world. And I can say that me and Tanya and the majority of our community is ready to not only fight for undocumented justice, but also for justice for Black people, justice for Asian people who are being mistreated because of the rhetoric that is being said because of COVID, justice for the LGBT community, because we demand that this world sees all humans as what Tanya said, as humans, rather than as a title or label that has been placed on us.
So, Tanya, you said that about seeing people as humans, but what about the whole concept of citizenship? It's given by birthright in the United States. That's not true in a lot of countries. And you can be born in different places and not be a citizen and not have the rights. But you're talking about two things, it seems to me. One is the birthright and the other is earning citizenship. Is there a distinction there?
Perhaps there is. Very like legally and logistically. But I think what we're trying to do with the podcast and with uplifting undocumented people's stories is really to talk about how we are a part of this country, regardless of that title and status. Because I think a lot of people are forgetting that currently we're just second-class citizens. Like I've been here for many, many years. It's been decades. And I still don't get to call myself a citizen. And it's a little less about having earned it because, you know, I don't quite know what qualifications would deem someone worthy. That would require some really intense ethical analysis maybe. But I've definitely been here for long enough and integrated myself. And you know, I've been a teacher teaching United States students. I just started my own nonprofit here in Colorado, and I'm sharing stories with other people who are also in the United States. If I were to be deported to Mexico, I don't know what I would do there. I haven't been there in many years. It's not my home. And I certainly feel like very much an American. So if that qualifies as me having earned it, I definitely think it should. And I also think about that fact that I think it's the United Nations or the Human Rights Declaration, one of those, that says that if a person has been in a country for more than 10 years, it's cruel and unusual punishment to remove them. And I just can't believe, you know, that we as a country are massing people who are second-class citizens and trying to deport them to countries that they haven't been to in so long. So, yeah, I mean, those are all the thoughts that come into my head for sure.
So, Tanya, you're anxious because politicians of different parties disagreed, lawsuits got filed, and now you have to wait for the U.S. Supreme Court. So how do you cope with that?
You know, the interesting thing is that for undocumented communities, we're actually used to this sort of relying on politicians to dictate our life, which is terrible. But it's not a new feeling for me to have to think about every single morning, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, at this point, every single week, every Monday, I have the tendency to wake up and just immediately Google like Supreme Court DACA decision. Did it happen today? Did it not happen? And that's my ritual every week, because it's supposed to come out in June. And, you know, it's definitely keeping me on the edge of my seat. But I also think that this reminds us that DACA was never the end solution. As Alejandro mentioned, it's not what we were always fighting for. We're fighting for actual congressional law. And so whatever the Supreme Court decides, I mean, ultimately, I do think they will probably side with Trump, given that they're a conservative Supreme Court. But whatever they decide, I think that I hope that the community and that people who can vote and can call their senators will realize that what we actually need is congressional change. What we need is to talk to our representatives and tell them that it's not okay to continue to have undocumented people serving as essential laborers, but not receiving any kind of support from the government, nor having any kind of status.
Are you heartened by what's happening now? A lot of people are saying, with these demonstrations going on all over the country, and even in small white towns in Utah and Idaho and places like that, they're on the streets actually demonstrating on behalf of people like yourself. Do you take hope from that? Is that a good thing? Are you happy to see it?
I do actually feel hope in seeing the protests and demonstrations. I think, so I've been a community organizer for many years now, and this is the first time in a while that I've seen it just go across the board all around the country. And it's beautiful to see everyone standing together. I mean, obviously there's a lot going on in the protest as well, because everyone's feeling angry and everyone's feeling a lot of different emotions. But for me personally, I do see it as a sort of like exciting to imagine that if DACA is terminated tomorrow or the day after or at some point, you know, that there will be people around the country who are already feeling that spark of fighting for justice. And if we all fight for each other's justice, I think we'll fight for a lot in this country, and we'll figure out how to get that liberation for everyone. So that definitely makes me feel that we're headed in the right direction, even if it's just through community support, which I think is always really helpful for other people to see me, as I said earlier, as like a human who needs that community support, if that makes sense.
Well, you're saying that you think that people may come out, turn out for you and march the streets for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you both again, and I can only wish you the best of luck, and maybe we'll have a chance to talk again. I hope so, and I hope it'll be in a more positive environment.
Yeah.
I hope so, too.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The producer of To the Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prebatary. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app, and if you want to reach us, we're at tothepoint_KCRW. If you want to reach me directly, I'm at WarrenAlney1. Thanks for being with us this time. Join us again, and don't forget to wear your mask.